Welcome to the Delta Flyers with Robbie and myself. And this week's guest is none other than Mr. John Billingsley. Welcome, John.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So good to have you. And you and your books. I see books.
Oh, there's books behind you.
Yes.
I'm thrilled with your library. I'm jealous of your library.
I'm going to ask you right off the bat, how do you categorize, or how do you, you know, arrange your books? How do you arrange them?
Technically, this is the room that runs from B to I for the fiction.
However, this is fiction?
Okay. Yes, I have. I back in the day, I think I've got about 15,000 books. So it's really a sicker. Some people are heroin addicts. Some people are gamblers. Some people are. I just wanted to live in a library.
You have the Billingsley Home Library, which is bigger than most.
I have a question when you say that you want to live in a library. So when I was young, we moved a lot when I was young. Yeah. Every couple of years we were moving.
Me too.
And so I was very much a lone wolf when I was a kid, because I just didn't seem to fit in. I was always the new kid, and I would spend my lunches, anytime I had free time. If I got to school early, I'd go to the library.
Yeah. I used to cut school to go to the library, and I'd call my mother and say, I wasn't in the mood. And she would, she would, of course, the token protestation. It's like, you can't. All right, I'll come pick you up. She'd come pick me up. We'd spend the whole day in the library.
Oh,
she'd browse, I'd browse. They had, when I grew up, they had a living room. It was floor to ceiling books, the whole room. And I would sit at the base of that bookshelf. And I didn't quite understand the concept of reading, but it was aspirational. It was like, these books were totemic. One day I am going to enjoy them the way I see my parents enjoy them.
Wow, that's beautiful. Well, it looks like you do enjoy it. For those just listening, John has so many books behind him. It looks like a bookstore.
There's so many.
That's one room. I also have an extraordinarily patient wife who is willing. I have to say, she initially, when we married, said, as long as they're not, piled up on the floor. Now it's like, as long as they're not on my side of the bed.
Here's one thing I'll say, John, that I've learned with that many books, with as many books as you have. Don't move, because moving the books is one of the biggest of all the things. And I've moved a few times the last few years. The books are the biggest pain in the butt.
Last move was from Silver Lake here, and that nearly killed me. And we've been 23 years, and they're going to have to, take me out.
You're done. The books have anchored you now. You can't move.
Yeah. If we had all the time in the world, I'd tell you a story about moving my books down from Seattle that nearly killed some people.
I bet. With that many books, I bet.
I was in a U-Haul and it's a big U-Haul. And, I was getting off the freeway and I exited and I was in the right-hand lane. I wanted to merge in the left-hand lane. Yeah. So I was off the freeway to take a left. And I signaled and I looked in the mirror and there was a Mack truck was in the left lane and they were scared and they swerved and they went like ass over teacup. And I thought, what the f- have I done?
Oh my God.
Cause you started making the lane change.
I signaled it.
Oh, God.
So anyway, I pulled over, a crowd gathered out of the cab of this, gargantuan truck.
18-wheeler, yeah.
Scott Bakula came out of that truck?
Scott Bakula and Jolene Blaylock.
That's That is the best story we've ever had. That is the best story we've ever had on this podcast.
Yeah, not true. No, but out of that cab, two 18-year-olds. They had a kid stole his dad's Mack truck for a joyride.
Oh my gosh.
So I waited for the cops and I explained the situation and people said, oh no, you were just this truck was barreling off the freeway.
Wow. And with all your books in the back, that would have been tragic. It would be sad to have lost you, but books.
I was safe. The books were a little tussled, but these two kids didn't get
it. Yeah, but you're so lucky first of all, what if that was somebody with a full load of merchandise that completely got, you know what I'm saying? This wasn't a regular truck driver. This was the kid stealing it from his dad.
Well, so and at first I thought I was responsible because I thought, you know, I was like, I didn't change lanes. But you know, in the moment.
Yeah, moment, what did I do? So, I must have.
Yeah, it's not your fault. It wasn't your fault, definitely. But still, it's also a relief to know that there was no merchandise ruined. No one's lives
being a tourist, I don't consider anything my fault, which is, as we were talking before, here, it's one of the wonderful qualities of Torians. It's like,
When is your birthday?
May 20.
We are the ideal triumvirate. Check it out, Robbie. He's Rat, you're Dragon. 1960 Rat, 1964 Dragon, 1968 Monkey. These are the ideal compatible signs in these three. So I said, if we were to collaborate on projects, so you direct and I act with John, this would be a blockbuster. This thing would be, we would knock it out of the park.
Really?
Yes. The best.
Don't even really need a script.
We don't even need it. No, we just, we improvise everything, Robbie. Everything's going to be improv.
The Dragon.
It's going to be a movie about a guy moving from Seattle. How an accident that's not his fault
changes his life.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be about.
Was just going out with Bonnie at the time, and I find, by the way, when I do an interview, it's usually just one question suffices for the entire interview.
So we're done. That's how good our signs are. We don't need to do it.
We don't even need.
I called Bonnie that day. It was like, early on in our relationship.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Honey, will you visit me in prison? I mean, no, we haven't been together very long, but yeah.
Were either of the vagrant boys injured in the accident? Were they okay?
No. And it took me a while, of course, to piece this together. The cops had to stick around and they came out of the cab and they were interviewed. Yeah. And the cop came over and said, okay, so here's what happened. Go home. You're fine. You have no, culpability.
No responsibility. Good.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. So going back to the books, because that's what I'm obsessed with your background.
Lie down in darkness.
William Styron's first novel.
Like a collectible of some sort.
Not necessarily. No, it was his first novel written in 1951. He wrote Sophie's Choice, one of the great American novelists. Only wrote four or five novels.
Oh.
His first one. Had absorbed a lot of Faulkner. I'm a big Faulkner fan.
Yeah.
But having said that, when you read a great novelist's virgin work, it's still like, wow. I'm a great fiction reader. That's sort of I read a lot of fiction and nonfiction, but primarily I'm a lover of fiction.
I want to get to Bourne and all that, but the book questions keep coming. What kind of fiction? Is it American authors? Is it European? Is it international?
Yeah, all over the map. I mean, I'm probably, not as well versed in European fiction, in part because the tiniest slice of world fiction gets translated into English.
Yes.
But having said that, no, I cover the waterfront for the most part. As I'm a fairly slow reader, actually, so it's not as if I've read everything in the world. Mm-hmm. I just like to always be reading something.
Mm-hmm. So, great.
Both you and Robbie are very similar in that regard. You read a lot or are always constantly reading something. And so what I wanted to add is that I know you guys read a lot when you were young. Did either of you do this? There was one year in high school where I didn't even go to the lunchroom. All my lunches were in the library for that whole year.
Oh, wow.
That was my contribution to the book.
I would go to the library at lunch, and my high school library you know, they would have the books and then they'd have magazines and newspaper subscriptions. Yep. And they would always get the Chicago Tribune Sunday Times in my high school. Why Chicago? I grew up in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Why Chicago and not the New York Times or Washington, you know, some other paper, but Chicago Tribune. And I would read the Chicago news. And so in my mind, I was going to Chicago. Like I knew Chicago. I knew the theater scene there. I knew the sports. I knew the politics. I was obsessed with Chicago.
Did you start off in Chicago?
I wanted to. No. Instead, I went to New York.
I tried to start off in Chicago myself.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't hack the weather.
Yeah, couldn't hack. It's cold. It's very cold. Yeah.
It's cold.
He went to New York.
It's like, it's, you know, there's like, where's the fall?
Yes. Yeah.
Where, there is none. There is no fall. Well, okay. Are we ready to jump into the
Let's go into our life story and see where that leads us.
Yeah. Born in Pennsylvania, correct?
They didn't stick around long. Media, Pennsylvania. My dad worked for GE.
My dad worked for GE too.
What?
In what capacity?
He was in the information services.
Your dad and my dad were the same dad? Holy shit.
Oh my God, that would be incredible. Now that's the movie we would make.
There's the movie.
We did a podcast. Then I get to direct that.
Can I direct that? Since it's your two
father. My father worked for General Electric Information Services, so the computer division of GE, and he dealt with customer. Yeah, it was customer service. So he would go out to companies that back then you couldn't buy computers for your business, so you rented time and information help from GE that had these giant mainframes. If you wanted to crunch data or store data, you know, your all kinds of things, you'd use GE's computers or IBM's or, you know, some of these big companies.
My father, who was gay, got to hire young, toothsome male morsels and place them in various training programs all over the country.
Wow.
What?
Heavenly job for my father. He started actually moving around the country back when NASA was in the middle of the, you know, their big push for Moonshot. So we were in Huntsville, Alabama, Slidell, Louisiana. Eventually moved to Southern Connecticut, which was culture shock because I taught like this.
How many years were you in Huntsville and Slidell? How many years was that?
Well, actually, we started Pennsylvania, Schenectady, New York, Fayetteville, New York, moved to Huntsville when I would have been four, was in Huntsville till I was six, Louisiana till I was eight-ish, nine-ish. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that Southern accent was already ingrained in you when you moved to Connecticut at that point.
Yeah, and a lisp.
Lisp.
I was a Southern boy, a frail Southern boy with a lisp.
To hear all your moves as a young child, and your dad worked for GE, that's exactly my life. My dad worked for GE, and we moved, you know, every couple of years. We were
gay?
My father was not gay that I know of, no.
Okay.
That's where our roads divide. It's a miracle I'm here.
So your father was gay. Was he out of the closet? Or was he still married to your mother? When did that...
No, it's for all the things that are f***ed up about the world and for everything that makes you want to tear your hair out these days. I do sometimes think we don't really have enough historical perspective. We don't remember what it was like to live in a world in which you simply could not be. You could not be. My father was a deeply closeted gay man because there was simply no way that you could be anything other than that in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
He was in the Navy. He got out of the Navy. He went to college, Antioch. He met my mother, who was 8 years older, who had a PhD in behavioral psychology. My dad was like wet behind the ears, okey. They married very quickly. Early on in the relationship, my mother caught my father ogling a gas station attendant and said, are you attracted to him? And he said, well, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And they stayed together.
And wow, my goodness.
As far as I know, they had sex twice and had two children. So, you know, it is truly a miracle.
But you're absolutely right. Like the historical perspective, because I remember, I'm four years young.
Stonewall, I mean, forget about it.
Yeah. I remember growing up in Atlanta, my junior high and high school years, because I was getting involved in the theater, I knew a lot of gay men and, you know.
Closeted gay men.
Closeted. Yeah. It was... the way that issue was dealt with in your life was so different. It was, it was a secret. It was something that you really didn't, you know, you didn't share with many people, if at all. And
But it wasn't, guys, it wasn't just, you know, I'm going to keep this a secret. If you came out back in the day of his father, you lose your social life, your business life, every part of your life is now done. Is, you know, I mean, it was so bad back then.
In subsequent years, I mean, I didn't know my father was gay until my mother passed away.
Really?
Odd story. My first wife, a wonderful woman named Janet Freiberger, she had cause to visit San Diego. My mother had passed away. They lived in Seattle. My dad relocated to San Diego. My wife at the time was in San Diego on business. Even though they didn't particularly get along, she thought, oh, I should be courteous. I'll see John's dad. My dad at the time was dating a Marine. They all went out to dinner. The Marine got pie-eyed, and at the bar next to Janet said, Bill, you know that. My wife comes home and says, John, did you know that your dad was gay? It was like, it's like the penny dropped.
It's like everything made sense.
So much made sense. I later found out from my older brother that, in fact, he had found a stash of my dad's gay pornography when he was a teenager that he hid in a filing cabinet.
That he never shared with you?
Shared with me.
Wow.
And it explained a lot about why my brother and my father had an estrangement that lasted until he died.
Oh, my goodness.
This, actually, I don't know why, I just have it at hand. Lie Down in Darkness is an interesting book. But a lot of it is about these buried family secrets. And, every family has odd ones.
It's funny you use the term family secrets, because one of my favorite podcasts, and here we are in our podcast, I'm going to pitch another podcast. there's a woman named Dani Shapiro, who is an author and found out very late in her life. Dani Shapiro found out through a DNA test that she did spontaneously with her husband. She found out that her father was not her biological father.
Happened to a friend of mine.
Oh my gosh.
And it opened up this reality of she was not, her father was not her father. It opened up this concept of family secrets. She started doing a podcast that is one of my favorite podcasts. She brings on guests who, the idea that every family has secrets is so true. And when you start to hear other people's lives, for me, it was cathartic. It was cathartic because every family's got things they just
fascinating. And if there's anything that, to me, you know, we sometimes fail to recognize about the modern age, is that many of those family secrets had to do with what was considered to be shameful.
Correct.
Your ethnic identity or your sexuality.
Yeah.
The idea in the modern world that we can be what we are, which is still, of course, under terrible assault. Generally speaking, it is one of the great accomplishments of our world that our identity is nothing to hide.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. Dani Shapiro uses a term, a phrase.
What is the podcast called, by the way, Robbie? What's the name?
It's called Family Secrets. It's called Family Secrets. That's the name. It's a fantastic podcast. She has a phrase she uses often that I love called the known unknown. And it's when there's something going on and you don't know exactly what's off, but you know something's off.
Yeah.
And then when it's known, when you know, and you kind of go, I knew there was something.
It made suddenly my whole childhood.
Everything makes sense.
Always seemed to have an interesting companionate relationship, but not one that ever seemed particularly physical or romantic. Why my father was always spending time in the city, not coming home. Why my mother was such a loner in certain respects. I mean, they had a wonderful relationship on some levels, but it there was always an absence.
Did your dad have siblings?
Dad had a younger brother who was also gay, and an older brother who was a roisterer, drunken roisterer.
Wow. Wow. So, okay. Three boys there.
My dad run away from home, but he hated his mother. He emancipated himself at 16. He said, I'm not going to live in this household anymore.
Oof.
Went to live with his aunt. He joined the Navy at 18 on his birthday in 1945.
Oh, so he saw action then?
No, we saw he was a clerk typist, so he saw typing action.
He saw a typewriter. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how we, I think so many of us, we choose one of two ways to go with that influence of our childhood traumas or our childhood influences. We either choose to cling tighter to it because it gives us some comfort in some way, and so trying to recreate it, or we completely reject it. You know, there's sort of this fork in the road where you kind of rebel in the opposite direction. If it's heavy religion that seems to have traumatized you in some way, you go anti-religion. Or if it's
I can see both of my parents having had certain traumas in their childhoods. I've had a relatively untraumatic childhood. I mean, my parents loved me. I had a good education. They were reasonably well off. I never felt, you know, in any way that I couldn't express myself freely or be who I wanted to be.
That's a great gift.
Yeah, yeah, it was a great gift. And they, early on, when I expressed an interest in drama, were nothing but supportive.
When you moved to Weston, Connecticut, that was at the age of 9. And at that point, you jumped into a new school. You have a lisp and a Southern accent. You're a frail kid. And you jumped into drama immediately? Or how did that happen?
It never entered my mind. I love to read. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they had a mandatory audition for the school class play in the 5th grade.
Oh, mm-hmm. Wow. You had to audition for it.
You had to read for it.
Okay.
Everybody in the, you know, 5th grade. And I was a big reader, so I could read with some degree of, you know, verve.
Yes.
And I was half the Scrooge. And so I was a pale, lisping, four-eyed Scrooge, nonetheless. So for one brief
with a Southern accent. How he ended up in London, we don't know.
I'm in no poorhouses. I'm in no what houses. So for
here's
one
Tiny Tim. Okay, go ahead.
Tiny Tim. I was working with a speech therapist to try and eliminate both the accent and the lisp.
You're being serious?
Really? Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Now, your parents asked for this?
They were astute.
Yes.
They realized certainly the lisp, you know, they wanted to grapple with.
Right.
And in the course of going to speech therapy, and also just, you know, you're living in a world where you're going to imitate people who don't sound like you.
Yeah. And,
So I lost the Southern accent pretty quickly.
Okay.
Lisp took a lot longer. But in any case, playing Scrooge, that brief, shiny moment of glory when all of a sudden you go from being the class pariah to the class star, and then it ended, and I went back to being the class pariah, and I thought, oh, I get it.
I got to do more of that. Yes. That is when the acting bug bit you then, when you played Scrooge. Well,
yes, I don't know if it was the acting bug. I think it might have been the you know, let's not get beat up at recess bug.
Right. The non-pariah bug.
Never got beat up. I was too tart-tongued. The bullies didn't really want to get into, you know.
Really? Your defenses were your daggerous comments.
Totally. I was a weenie physically, but I never backed down from anybody because I just wouldn't. So
you were one of those kids that had comebacks for anything or any situation. You were verbal kung fu master.
I would occasionally get into a fight because somebody would like it. Why do you tell me? But generally speaking, I wasn't really bullied.
Right.
However, I was a class pariah. I don't think particularly, you know, loathed me for my own qualities, but generally speaking, nobody was going to approach me. So this period of glory, and after that, I asked my parents if I could take acting class, and they found a couple, Ed and Dorothy Bryce, who used to be on The Guiding Light.
Until
alcoholism derailed their careers.
Oh.
They started teaching acting classes.
That's great. That's a great move to kids. When you can't fit in because you're a drunk with adults, let's go hang out with a bunch of kids.
They went on the wagon. If their son Scott Bryce is listening to this, Scott, you know I adore Ed and Dorothy.
Okay.
Long gone now, but they were wonderful teachers of mine. Aww. I studied with them for a number of years. And they actually had an acting class that kind of allowed kids to study with adults.
Oh, wow.
So kind of cool because I was not taking a kid's acting class.
Right.
I was a kid in acting class.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Huh.
That but I mean, said, my parents would never have let me, you know, like go into New York and try to audition. So I was doing because I liked it, not because I had professional
community theater just as a hobby. Yeah. It was your passion. It was your hobby, but they
Yeah, but I feel like this couple was—they were very influential in your development as a young actor. Were. You know, I mean, if without them, you wouldn't be here. I feel
have their pictures on my wall.
There you go.
No, they were lovely, lovely, lovely folks, lovely people.
And Weston, just so people listening know, Weston, Connecticut is near Westport, Connecticut, and is that Fairfield County? So Fairfield County, Connecticut is on the border of New York State and not far. It's a bedroom community for a lot of people that Long work Island, in the city.
Long Island Sound, you take the LARR end of the city. My dad was a commuter for years. So
yeah.
I was in and out of the city growing up, was a big Mets fan, you know.
So even though it's in Connecticut, it's more like a New York suburb?
A lot of people in that part of the world kind of call themselves, you know, quasi New Yorkers.
New Yorkers. Okay. Thank you for explaining that.
It's got its own kind of country New England charm to where John grew up.
Yeah, it's, but it's very Fantasy Fred Nethel in the later years of I Love Lucy. That's where they moved.
Yeah.
So how long does it take in public transport to get from West End to New York City to Manhattan?
It's about 30 minutes to the train station, and then the train is maybe 45 minutes.
45 minutes, yeah.
So not bad at all. Really close.
No, it's not a bad commute. And it was a very... Like Paul Newman lived out there, I think.
Oh.
Betty Davis, she turned the hose on me when I was a child.
Are you serious?
Out my yard!
Fairfield County had really strong ties to that old, a lot of entertainment was based on that community, you know, sitcoms, Dick Van Dyke Show, things like that. They were all they sort of lived in that world. It wasn't a California... Okay. It was
Cheever country, you know. I mean, if anybody's a fan of John Cheever, you know, a lot of his books were written about the bedroom communities of New York. People are always taking the train. Yeah. Usually getting it. My dad, I have to say, would be like, "Hi, Dad, how you doing? Spend a little time in the bar car coming home tonight." Back when they had a bar car. Got rid of the bar car.
Oh my god. Yeah. I love Fairfield County. I love where you grew up. When I lived in New York City, that was always a fantasy of mine to somehow move out to Fairfield County and go into the city. I worked in plays in New York City with actors, older actors that had done that had moved out to Connecticut, and that's where they lived, and they came in, did their Broadway show.
No, I mean, the only problem is it's white with a little dash of white. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Very preppy.
Weston, Connecticut was, you know, I mean, this is what you don't really realize when you're growing up. I mean, you don't necessarily have your finger on the pulse of the world.
Yeah.
I didn't know until I was much older that I led a privileged existence, but I also led a blinkered existence.
Yes. Yeah. Great
public school. As far as I can recall, two African American students.
Really?
Wow.
So ethnic diversity almost nil. What about Asian students? Was there an Asian student in your school? No?
Maybe.
Wow.
Well, and I won't say the world has changed, because I suspect if you went to Weston, Connecticut, you would probably still find the same, you know, this
pretty close. I bet it feels a bit timeless there.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Lucas, I think, that was about the wonderful, wonderful nonfiction writer. It was about the Boston, the years in which Boston tried to desegregate.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his fundamental arguments is the North kind of like is gets very sort of like, oh, the Southerners, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But racism is an American disease. It manifests itself differently in the North. In the South, you're living right next door to a person of another, the rules, the codes, the strictures, but in the North, people, this is a gross generalization, can tend to have more, you know, how do I say this, progressive attitudes, because they live in a community in which there are no people that
it's not challenged. Yeah. There's no challenges for them to their their, you know, whatever
their lifestyle, their existence.
They want to claim a position, but they don't have to actually
defend it,
live it. They don't have to
live it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
wow.
It's okay. Wonderful. Another book called The Big Sort. And this guy's argument is that every 10 years, we should treat the country like a blanket. We should pick it up by the four corners and toss everybody in the air.
I love it.
They would come down and they would have to kind of like learn how to get along.
Figure it out.
Yeah. I love it.
And historically, he says, look at all the eras in American history. For instance, when
that happened,
Second World War started, people had to fan out all over across the country. It changed the nature of everything.
Yeah.
You know,
it's true. You graduate from high school. And at that point, did you go to college immediately? And if you did, was it drama?
Absolutely was opposed to going to college. I wanted to go to New York. I wanted to study. I wanted to do walkabout. I wanted to chase girls. Anything I wanted to do, none of it had to do with going to school.
Wow.
I was a shitty student. I was a terrible student. I got by.
Yeah.
Because I am pretty quick-witted. But yeah. I never liked to study. As soon as somebody assigned a book, it was like, I am not reading that book. Odd rebelliousness in me.
Yeah.
But my parents were like, you're going to college. And although at the time I thought, well, what if I'm not? What if I'll just go off and be by myself in New York and I'll get a job. I didn't seem like that was an option somehow. Yeah. I kind of went, all right, then I'm going to a girls' school with no grades.
So Sarah Lawrence, where'd you go?
Bennington.
Bennington. Oh.
So I did my research. What are the schools that have more girls than boys and that don't have grades and don't make you take shit you don't want to take? And I only applied to those schools.
Wow.
I was Bennington a merit scholar, so Bennington paid for it. So I got more or less a free ride, and I chased girls, and I didn't have grades, and I only took acting, and I got out in 4 years.
So what was your major then when you were in Bennington?
Theater.
It was theater.
Okay. I was going to go the double major. I studied, again, I don't know if you're, do you know who Bernard Malamud is?
Mm-mm.
Sadly, and I bizarrely neglected writer, one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. He was up there with Othello and Roth as the three big Jewish American writer heavyweights. He wrote The Natural, the
book. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
On the National Book Award for The Fixer, wrote The Assistant, one of the most beautiful novels you'll ever read. He was my teacher.
Wow.
Like studying acting with Olivier when you're 18 years old. So I thought, I guess I'm not a writer.
Bennington is known for producing some of the greatest writers.
Donna Tartt is a Bennington. Yeah. John Latham briefly went to Bennington.
Jonathan Latham, one of my favorite writers.
Jonathan
Latham.
Actually, Fortress of Solitude has a section set at Bennington. Not if you've read that one.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I knew very well that what parties he was talking about, the dress to get laid parties at Bennington, which I never got laid, no matter what I wore.
Did we say Bret Easton Ellis went there as well?
I don't count him. Bret Easton.
Yeah. Oh,
there. Sorry, don't count him. No offense. They have for years one of the biggest and most successful summer writing workshop programs.
Oh yeah.
Now, a lot of great writers and a lot of great teachers. George Garrett was a teacher of mine. Another sadly neglected writer, Nick Del Banco, was a teacher of mine. I could have graduated with a double major. I had to write I had to do a thesis, or I had to write a novel, basically, or collection. It was like, I don't need to be a double major.
Well, of all your teachers in college, who was the most important?
And Nicky Martin.
And why?
You probably know Robbie Nicholas Martin, the director. He passed away a couple of years ago. He, at that time, was kind of persona non grata as an actor. He'd had a drinking problem.
Mm.
And his friend, Leroy Logan, who was the head of a drama department at Bennington, asked him to come and teach. And he came and was a wonderful teacher, a dear human being, and became a dear friend, and became a director. And the first show he ever directed was Under Milkwood, that I was in.
And
directed, Camino Real, which I was in. It wasn't like I needed inspiration. I mean, I pretty much knew I was at a certain point. So once it was clear I wasn't going to be a writer, I was going to have to be an actor because I don't have any different skills other than that. So So it wasn't like I needed somebody, but he was possibly the person I got the most out of as a teacher.
What were the things that, if you can articulate them, that Nicholas Martin sort of inspired you, like when you think of him as a creative inspiration?
So much, I think, of what makes a teacher compelling in your memory is simply the nature of what the personality was and how you attached to it and how much you invested in it. But if there's anything that I took away, that, you know, I think this is true for actors, it takes years and years and years before you fully understand it, is the primacy of action, the nature of how every moment you are actively engaged in the pursuit of something that you want or need. Mm-hmm. And the idea that as long as you're honest in the active moment, you're not in your head. You're not worrying about trying to conjure an emotional reaction. You're not worried about trying to manifest a behavior. You're simply in pursuit of something. I think that was probably my biggest discovery as a young actor, even though it took me many years, I think, to kind of really absorb it fully. The nature of what it meant to be active on the beat, active on the beat. Mm-hmm. He was also Meisner influenced, so probably the other thing that was most important for me to learn is that within that space of being active on the beat, you also have to be wide open to the reality of the other person's behavior and let it affect you. Those two things can ever come together in your work, you're probably going to be okay.
Agreed. I love that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Those inspirational mentors that we have in life, often we attach to their personality as much as technique or ideas or any of that. There was a high school mentor of mine, Linda Wise. I've mentioned her before in this podcast. Linda was she was a Tennessee Williams character. She was kind of a heavyset woman. Big personality. She smoked cigarettes in a cigarette holder that went out 2 feet from her face.
Oh my gosh.
She always had these amazing berets on and wore these kind of house dress, homemade things. And her personality, and she lived in this Victorian home in this tiny town called Conyers, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. And in the front of the house, she had a wine and cheese shop. And she would have these salons on Sundays where she'd invite people just to hang and drink wine and cheese and talk about literature and art and ideas. And, you know, so to describe how Linda inspired me, it was this thirst for life and an experience in life, in a way, more than, you know, a particular, you know, creative acting process.
Nicky had just he was the possibly the funniest human being I've ever met. I just adored his absolute mastery of any situation. He simply was, it was like, you know, having Kitty Carlisle be your or Moss be your teacher, you know.
Right.
You felt like you were directly connected to some aspect of what you always read about when you were growing up, you know, how to be New York stage, the Algonquin Circle. He represented something to me that felt very, very significant about that few. Mind you, I never got to actually be in the Algonquin Roundtable or ever appeared on a New York stage.
So you finished Bennington, and after that, you made the trip to Seattle. Where did you go after Bennington?
I spent a fair amount of time traveling. They had sort of a Bennington Abroad program, so I got to go and spend some time in London and study with teachers affiliated with RADA.
Oh, that's awesome!
Act some time on. Bennington also had something called the non-resident term. In the winter months, you were supposed to go out and get a gig, primarily because they couldn't afford to heat the joint. And so they ended up charging you money to go get a job, and they called that your education. It's like, what a racket. So I managed to convince them to allow me to bop around the world and write about it as part of my fulfillment of my writing.
Look at you.
Oh, I spent almost a year out of the country. And when I came back, my last term at Bennington, when I graduated, my parents had hit the road when I went off to college. They sold their house in Connecticut. I hadn't seen them for 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
They settled in Seattle. So I thought, I'll go visit my best friend and I, Chris Weigel, another wonderful theater person, used to be involved in running the Huntington in Boston, dear pal. We hitchhiked across the country back when you could hitchhike.
Oh my gosh.
So we managed to get to Seattle. We didn't have a dime. But I had to think about this. How am I going to get back to New York? I'll just hang out with my parents for a while. I didn't realize Seattle had a fairly vibrant theater scene.
Yeah.
I started auditioning. Long story short, I ended up spending 13 years in Seattle.
By the way, hitchhiking, to go back to hitchhiking. So we talked to Frakes a few weeks ago. Frakes also hitchhiked across the country, but he was arrested. He was arrested because it was illegal. He and his buddy got thrown into jail and spent the night in jail. But he said the cops felt kind of bad because they seemed like good kids and they fed him well. And they took him right back to where they had picked him up hitchhiking in the end.
Dropped him off and said, continue.
Just don't hitchhike from here.
Just don't let us catch you doing this again.
We got as far as Chicago. And we hit Chicago. It's like, okay, we don't have any dough. We got to get from Chicago to Seattle.
That's a long way.
Like, I don't know how confident I feel about that. So we scraped up enough dough to get Greyhound tickets. But we did get from Vermont to Chicago, and it was a circuitous route. We went down the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah.
It was a great time. I mean, my time with Chris, traveling across the country with Chris, one of the highlights of my life. He's 6'6", and he weighs about 9 pounds. He's like thin as a rail.
Oh, God.
I'm me. So we traveled together. We had these little ridiculous signs, you know, like going south with a picture of a cocktail glass. And and I think people just thought two more non-threatening bozos could not exist. So we got picked up all the time.
Chris, because the old Abbott and Costello look that you guys had going on? Is that okay?
And Chris would always, because, you know, you're still going to get picked up by lunatics.
Yes.
Chris would always pretend, if the driver seemed to be like nuts, Chris would always pretend to fall asleep. Be like, I get one, you have to deal with them.
Yeah,
I have the burden of conversation.
Robbie, did I tell you this? My dad, when he was a college student, when he was a graduate student, picked up a hitchhiker who then proceeded to pull a knife out on him.
What?
Yeah, and he said, give me all your money. And my dad pulled out, he had $4 on him. So this was 1966, right? And they got, and he goes, well, this is all I have. He goes, well, give it all to me. And he goes, my dad goes, but I don't, this is my lunch. I have to eat lunch. And the guy goes, fine, take $2 back and I'll take the other two. And then he like, and then he goes, let me off here. And so he robbed my dad of half of his money, but my dad was able to, of $2 instead of all four. But he was,
that was nice of him.
It was nice of him. And also it was nice that he didn't stab my dad either. So
yeah, that's true.
Cause I wasn't
also, this is a weird hitchhiking story. I was also hitchhiking in England and the guy picked me up in Rye and we started gabbing. And where are you from? Blah, blah, blah. I said, Western Connecticut. He said, oh, I lived in Western Connecticut for a while. And I said, oh, where'd you live? And he said, Lilac Lane. And I said, I lived on Lilac Lane.
What?
And he said, you lived on Lilac Lane? And I said, yeah, I lived on number 13, Lilac Lane. He said, the house at the end of the road with the long driveway. And I said, yeah. He said, I lived in that house.
What?
No. Weird.
Wow.
And if it had been me, like, you know, if he was just saying that to get in my pants, which, of course, everybody wanted to do at the time. But he was providing.
And still do, by the way. Still do.
They still do.
Everybody wants to get in your pants.
You got to be kidding.
That's crazy.
He had lived there like 15 years earlier.
Oh, my God.
What are the odds? No, England.
No.
In Rye, England. Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. When you did go abroad, other than London, you said you were at RADA, which was probably an amazing experience, right? You had. No, not so much. Okay.
They have very different, you know, I mean, theirs is so technique oriented.
Where else did you travel besides England? You said you went to multiple places.
We went to, we started in Ireland. We took to Dublin. We bicycled across to Galway. We took a fishing boat to the Aran Islands. We went from Ireland to Spain. We went as far as, we went to Barcelona, Sevilla, Granada, up through Madrid. We went to Venice. For the we definitely wanted to get to Venice for the Carnival.
So
this is one of the highlights of my life.
Wow.
Then I met a woman there and I left my pal because the gal and I were going to have we had an affair in Paris. Traveled to southern France together. She was Australian. She had to split. And then I went back to England and spent some time in the southeast southeast coast of England.
So the pal that you were with is the same person that you hitchhiked to Seattle with?
Nope, different pal. That was a different pal, another pal of mine from college.
Okay.
Who was built like a brick, Michael Rogers, the handsomest guy. It was a little debilitating because everywhere we went, especially in Spain, all the Spanish senoritas would follow him going, well, Rubio, Blondie, Blondie, be like, what am I, chopped liver? Like we had to split up. It's like, I, you know what? You go your way.
He drew too much attention. Get that guy out of here. Oh my goodness.
So this is the that European tour is what you wrote your thesis or your college paper about.
Yeah, it turned out that that was not going. It turned out. I thought that was going to be the what would allow me to get a double major. They said no, no. This fulfills your non-resident term.
Oh no.
Apply it to, you know, in essence, every job was supposed to be kind of in the further fulfillment of a degree you were taking. This will further fulfill your degree in the English department, but you don't get to get off of having a thesis. So it was like, fine.
Oh man.
Do you still have that paper?
Yeah.
What was the takeaway when you try to capture a trip like that, which sounds incredible?
My primary goal was to be unexpurgated. And in part, it was also because my parents so graciously, I mean, I had a free ride at Bennington. But nonetheless, my parents were fronting, you know, certain costs, and they certainly fronted that trip. And, yeah. and I thought, you know, maybe one of the best, what you're talking about, when you're talking about writing something for your kids.
Yeah.
I thought possibly the best thing I could do for my parent was to say, I love you enough to not be guarded. So I won't write it from a point of view of this is how it's sanitized for presentation to my dear sainted parents. This will be what, you know, this will be what happened.
No secrets, no family secrets.
So I wrote about, you know, everything that you feel when you're on the road. It's like, where am I going to store some hashish? How come I can't get laid? Why am I traveling with the sun god here? It's driving me crazy.
I want to read this. Yeah. Would you allow me to, can I read this, please?
We're going to publish a link on the podcast next, but I wish we could.
I will tell you this, when the first time when my pal and I, we went through Paris from Italy, Ireland before we traveled south to Spain. First time we checked into our hotel in Paris, there was like this what I took to be a wine cooler in the bathroom. It's like, this is weird. Why would they put a wine in the bidet? But, you know, my pal and I, we kind of looked at it. We thought, well, this is so strange. What could it possibly be for? It has to be a wine cooler. So we stuck our white wine in there. And each day we'd come back and the white wine would be on the dresser. And we'd go, why did they take the white wine out of the cooler? It finally, at some point, somebody said, that is where you wipe your ass. It is where you wash your ass.
Like, wow.
Oh. Who knows? We left the chambermaid a big tip. In our little
The wine cooler.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And we thought at the time, it's like, it's not very cold.
So you thought this one's broken. Wait a minute. You guys thought the bidet was where you would put the wine.
And you turn the water on and it would cool. It would chill the wine.
I thought the French love wine. What else could it possibly be?
I
had never heard of the concept of additional
cleansing.
Yeah.
Thing for the bottom.
No. So this is in your paper too.
Oh yeah.
I want to read this paper. So I'm so serious. Like I'm going to come. I can't wait to. I'm coming to your house tomorrow.
It was more of a journal. I mean, it wasn't.
I don't care. I want to read this. This is going to be.
I haven't read it in years.
There you go. We can read it together.
As far as your acting career.
Oh, right.
That part. So you're in Seattle, which did have a vibrant theater scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you spent 13 years there doing theater.
I started a theater company.
Yeah, tell us about that time.
The big flagship theater there is the Seattle Rep. There were also at the time was ACT, the Empty Space. There was enough theater to get by. There was enough industrial film, commercial work, occasional TV or film to make a living. There was a point in my life when I thought, this is not satisfying to me, and I either have to A, move to New York, B, move to Los Angeles, or C, figure out some way to do something here that feels more fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
A woman named Jane Jones introduced this concept to some of us, presenting fiction verbatim on stage, which we put some stories up. I loved it. I've always been a big reader, so I thought this would be great, but you're going to need a shitload of people to come together to put stories up every month in a workshop presentation to figure out what is the best, and then the best of the best you take on the road, you tour, and then you do put it up for bigger audiences. We called that shambolic entity Book It. And I ran it along with some other folks, including Jane and Myra, who eventually took it over when I left, for about 5 years. That was a big, big part of my life. I learned a lot doing it. I learned a lot about how to pursue the business of the business, because I was an artistic director, and you got to figure out how to, you know, keep a roof over your head. My marriage ended, and I was also teaching.
Was the Intimon Theater already in existence in Seattle at that point? Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Intimon, the group, Tacoma Actors Guild. There were maybe 10, 11, you know, equity houses and, mm-hmm. and then a number of fringe houses.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Seattle has always had a great theater scene there, a theater community.
Mm.
Very highly respected. Yeah. Seattle Rep is the most famous.
You got divorced at that. And then after that.
The divorce kind of was like, okay. You know, those lines in your life where it's like, if not now, when?
Yeah.
And I realized that while I got a lot out of being an artistic director, it's demanding, it's grueling. I was not making any money. It was going to be years before the theater company was going to be able to make enough money for me to be able to pay myself. I really made my money teaching acting. I taught Meisner for a number of years.
Oh.
Just thought, you know, I don't want to teach anymore. Hmm. At which point it was like, what do I do? And I decided, you know, I always liked the limited experience I had doing film and TV. I like that. I like those mediums. I like not having to worry about how you justify the performance choice to hit the back wall.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Yeah.
Challenge of theater. So I moved to LA in 1995.
And that's when Robbie and I started our show. That's when our show premiered in 95, actually.
When you made that move, did you feel like it was a smooth transition? Did you immediately have success, or were there...
It took 2 years, which I think, you know, relatively speaking, I mean, the odd thing I've always said to younger actors is the experience of running Book It was incredibly valuable, because when you are running a business, you simply have no choice when it comes to the actions. If you have to pay the rent, you have to pay the rent. If you have to have a conversation with a company member, that's hard. You have to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Coming here, I felt like what I was able to bring to the table was simply a realistic appraisal of how do you go about getting a career going, and what are the tough things you're going to have to do that other people don't want to do. I was mm-hmm. never shy about going in and saying, I got to have a conversation with you, agent. This is not working out, and here's what I need, and here's what I'm not getting.
Good for you.
So to a certain extent, the first 2 years were learning the city, kind of getting to understand what was required to get to know the casting directors. Are workshops valuable? Are showcases valuable? How do you mm-hmm. how do you kind of, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to make a hard decision, which was to say I'm not going to pursue theater.
Mm.
Because it felt to me, I've had a lot of different conversations with people down the years about this, it felt to me that the friends I had who were trying to be theater actors and film and TV actors were kind of, you know, falling between two stools.
Yep. Yeah.
I found if I was doing a play, I worked for a while at Noise Within here locally, that when I'd get home, if I had an audition and I had to prepare material, I'd be beat. I'd just been at a rehearsal or I'd done a show. I was mm-hmm. probably not going to go in that next day. Back then, frequently you had those next day auditions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes a shitload of language. I thought I'm not gonna put my best foot forward. I've just got to make this my raison d'etre.
Mm-hmm. So very smart of you.
Did you know a lot of people when you came to LA?
Yeah, fair number, but I make friends pretty easily.
I
knew a fair number of people. I mean, there was a whole contingent of folks who had been moving down from Seattle in part because Seattle lost that limited amount of film, TV, commercial work it did have to Canada. Yeah. And a lot of people went FICOR, so they were able to have a lot more, they were able to hire non-union actors. It just became impossible unless, you know, you had a really cushy day job or you were really riding the cream of the cream on the theater circuit to make mm-hmm. a living. So a lot of people started moving down here. So I knew a fair number of folks.
So you knew a fair number. You talk about when you were running the theater company, artistic director, and learning the practical elements of running a theater and how to have hard conversations, things like that. Do you think that helped you when you're on set now and you've got a creative difference with a director or the material or writer or even another actor, you know, blocking a scene?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, as you know, I think the biggest accommodation you have to make to being on a set is that the clock is the clock. You don't have time to have the kind of conversation you might have if you are in rehearsal for a play.
Yeah.
So if you have a solution, great. If you don't have a solution, then you have to figure out how to make the direction you're getting function. And I'm generally not somebody who is going to engage in a shitload of conversation unless I'm very clear about what I think might make it better.
I remember that I was directing an episode, and there was one day where I had fallen way behind. And the very last scene of the day was, I think, you and Scott and Jolene in your lab, where you make a huge discovery. And it was like a 2.5-page scene. It was a big scene. Uh-huh. And I remember Mary Howard had come down, and I was easily 2 hours or more behind. And we had thought this long scene was going to take 3 hours. And we had basically 45 minutes left in our day. As you said, the clock was ticking. Yeah. And I remember going to you and Scott and Jolene and saying, if you guys can help me work this out, we'll do this scene as a wonder. Get out of here. Do you remember that scene?
No.
Oh, I remember. I remember it vividly. And it was one of the first times where I had to abandon my plan completely and sort of get to the heart of what the scene needed to be for the story, and then think of a way to do that in 45 minutes, period. That was the goal. And we did it as a handheld wonder, and you guys shot it, and we got it done in 45 minutes and wrapped on time. I couldn't believe it. It was
like... I don't remember that. The memories we have as actors are so are so rooted in, like, one horrible memory I have from that particular show is I had gone out drinking and carousing the night before, and I came home. This is back when the pages would be delivered at the door.
Yes.
And there were new pages, and it was two new scenes with me.
Yeah.
With words. I didn't even think I was working the next day.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, and I came in that next day, and I got through the first scene okay. Oh. But the second scene, shot late in the day, Roxanne was directing.
Oh.
There was, you know the show we were on. It was some of the scenes with the gobbledygook. It was, some space alien species that I'd never heard of. And I was like, take 12. What are they? Metoxels. What are they? The metoxels. The whole crew was going, metoxels.
Metoxels, say it.
And finally, Rock said, all right, forget it. We're not getting this scene.
Rarely happened.
I mean, that's just circumstance.
You were my hero on the scene I was describing. I've recapped that scene for others since and other directors on, you know, the clock is the clock, as you said earlier. Yeah. And sometimes reality is reality, and you've got to find a way.
Well, and you know, I mean, we're always, it's like, it is, even on that show, there were times when it's sort of like somebody would say, I think in this scene, my character would have, you know, a sippy cup. It's like, what? Yeah, I really think in this scene I should have a sippy cup. Like, get him a sippy cup. Well, we can't find a sippy cup. How about a glass? No, it got to be a sippy cup. It's like, yeah.
Time.
You know, if it's not something big, if it's not central, if it's not, and if you can't figure out something to offer that is going to help solve the scene or shift the thinking on a scene, then it's better just to, I think, you know, I tend to not, although I'm pretty voluble, I tend to not talk too much unless I really think there's something that I can be pithy about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Robbie, in the end, I just want to ask Robbie this real quick. In the end, when you watch that episode that you directed, that wonder is absolutely fine, right? It doesn't stand out. It's
more than fine. It's better than my original idea.
It
worked out. The episode needed that energy, the scene, because it was a turning point in the story.
Yeah.
It was a discovery. It was putting together sort of connecting dots and saying, there's our answer. It was an aha scene.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
You know, You know, the Bishop's Wife, the Cary Grant. There's a scene in the Bishop's Wife where it's just like it's just the master, and actors slowly enter the frame from various off stage points until the frame is filled up with Cary Grant and David Niven and Loretta Young and you know two or three other the dog, and it's about their arrival and the playing of the scene, and the camera never, we don't have any close ups at all. And it's like, you know, a fairly lengthy scene. And it's just, I miss that.
I miss that too.
We just live in a world in which if you don't have a gajillion cuts,
yeah,
it's not considered interesting enough for an audience.
Well, what I loved about the scene that we did, and you guys made it work, was that it hinged on the energy of your performances. And you guys, you know, knew the words. That was a day where you knew your words inside and out. And
only
everybody
that
did.
One day I didn't know my words.
But everybody sort of rose to the challenge and allowed our real circumstances of filmmaking to fuel the imaginary circumstances of the scene, which is we need an urgent solution to this problem. And how can we rethink this in the scene? That's what the scene was about. And it all came together beautifully.
So. Our show got better, I thought, towards the end, because urgency was put in a way that I kind of thought was lacking generally in our show on the first and second season.
I didn't do a lot with you guys, maybe three or four episodes in total, but I always enjoyed coming over there. It was a great group.
There was one episode you and I did get to work on a lot. It was sort of about a fellow from a species that we were perpetually at odds with.
Yes.
That was lovely. I so enjoyed it. That was probably one instance where I really got to work with you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have we've thoroughly enjoyed having you on and hearing your stories and filling in some blanks that we've had. And so we want to thank you, John, for being on the podcast today. You're a wonderful, wonderful guest. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And I can't believe both of our fathers worked for GE and we moved around every 2 years.
Oh, I should probably close by saying everything I said, Tissue of Lies.
Yes.
In fact, if you wanted to call the episode Tissue of Lies,
that is the title of your autobiography, I think.
Tissue of Lies. Actually, it's Suitably Rumpled, but Tissue of Lies.
Suitably Rumpled? Is that what you said? Oh, I love
Suitably
that.
Rumpled, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, John. It was great. Yeah. So great to hear your stories and things I never knew.
I'll come back to talk about the Hollywood Food Coalition.
Yes. When it comes time, we could do
that. The Hollywood Food Coalition needs its own episode because there's lots to talk about there.
That's a huge part of my life. But
I know it is.
Yeah.
I know it is. Well, for those that don't get to hear the Hollywood Food Coalition special episode that we will do down the road, just remember that's really important to John.
What's the web address?
HoFoCo.org.
There you go. HoFoCo.org.
As opposed to the whole Pan Can address. I know. HoFoCo, Hollywood Food Coalition, HoFoCo.org.
Yeah.
And we will do Trek Talks 3 at some point.
Yes, that is a charity very near and dear to John Billingsley's heart that everyone should definitely check out and donate and get involved. All right, for all of our Patreon patrons, please stay tuned for your bonus material.